Welcome to our 11th lecture through this series on church history. And in this series, we're really only dealing with the first general era of church history, or the first half, we should say, from the founding of the church to the time of Reformation. So we're going up to about the year 1500. And within that general framework of the start of Christianity, the first century to the year 1500, we've divided it up into several different places, several different eras. So first we talk about the apostolic church. That's approximately to the year AD 100. Then we talk about the period of the early church. That's approximately AD 100 to about 312. And now we're considering a large portion of time that I call the time of the Christian Empire. And I would say that in general, we're talking about the period from 312, the conversion of Constantine, which we've spoken of in a previous lecture. You have about the year 312 going all the way to the year 1500. Now, that's such a long period of time, almost 1200 years, that we're dividing it into an early period going to about the year 1000 and a later period from about 1000 to 1500. And I recognize that these divisions are always somewhat artificial. We're not talking about hard and fast dates. We're talking about just general eras, allowing for a lot of generalities, a lot of overlap. Now, we're talking about this period of the Christian Empire, the early period, again, approximately 312 to about 1000 AD, AD 1000. Today, in this lecture, the 11th lecture, we want to talk about the good and bad of monasticism. I think it's really important to understand the huge impact that the monastic movement, monks, monasteries, nuns, abbots, the different monastic orders, cloisters, that whole infrastructure throughout Western Christianity and Eastern Christianity as well, had a huge impact on the Christian world of that time and even continuing to our day. And I think it needs to be framed in a certain perspective. And let me use this illustration to sort of frame that perspective. There were Roman coins that had the inscription, Invicta Roma Aeterna. That just simply means unconquerable Rome eternal. And that's how it seemed. Because the survival of the Roman Republic and then the Roman Empire for some 1,000 years was amazing. Was several times when it seemed like it might have been shattered. But even an empire that lasts for 1,000 years, and that's what Rome was, it's really remarkable. Even an empire that lasts for 1,000 years, humanly speaking, an empire that man won't last forever. And in 410, the city of Rome itself was invaded, burned, and plundered. In fact, the Roman Empire in the West had been falling for many years. The Visigoth chief Alaric had already besieged Rome on two occasions before the year 410. And both times he had been bought off by by bribes from wealthy Roman senators who thought that, you know, with those kind of negotiations and maneuvers that they could delay an imminent disaster. But when Alaric and his army came to the gates of Rome in the year 410, the besieged citizens were at the point of starvation. They really didn't have anything that they could bargain with. They had given it away all before. So they tried to bluff their way out of the crisis by telling Alaric that if he invaded the city, thousands of Romans would rise up to defend the city against him. Alaric answered this. He said, "The thicker the grass, the more easily it is mowed down." Alaric knew that he was in a far superior position strategically, militarily, than those who were defending the city of Rome. And so he was in the position to be able to make demands. And Alaric had one demand. This is what he said. "Everything. I want all the gold, all the silver, all the temple ornaments, anything that can be seized and carried away, including many of the slaves that populated the city." He said, "I want anything I want in the city." And the Roman negotiators answered back to Alaric. They said, well, what are you going to leave us? And this is what he said. He said, your lives. So on a fateful night of August 24th, again the year 410, someone inside the city of Rome opened one of the reinforced gates, recently reinforced. There were 12 of them. And Alaric's army flooded into the streets of Rome. For 3 days, they plundered, they pillaged, they terrorized the city. The great Bible translator Jerome will speak of him in a later lecture. He was in Bethlehem when he heard that Rome had been invaded, and he couldn't speak for 3 days. Jerome, who once lived in the city of Rome, he said this, "The city to which the whole world fell has now fallen. If Rome can perish, what can be safe?" A British monk who happened to be in Rome when the city fell wrote this. He said, "Every household has its grief, and an all-pervading terror gripped us." Now, in the year 455, the Vandals, led by a man named Genseric, they invaded Italy, and they also plundered Rome. That was even more devastating than Alaric's raid some 45 years before that. The Roman Empire limped along until the year 476. That was the date of its very decisive, definitive fall, when another barbarian chieftain, Odovacer, he deposed the boy emperor Romulus Augustulus. And Rome then joined a very long list of great powers that fell and eventually were conquered. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greek, and now Rome. Yet, with the possible exception of Egypt, none of those empires had reigned so long as Rome. Certainly, none of them reigned during periods of such progress and development of technology, progress and development of knowledge, of business, of agriculture, and order. Now, why do I say all that connected to monasticism? When Rome fell, it had a devastating impact on the Western world. In a way that we, in our modern Western world, have never been familiar with, after the fall of Rome, things went backwards. If someone compared the world of the Western Roman Empire in the year 350 to the year 650, people lived shorter lives, they were much poorer, they had much less technology, much less literacy, and much less order in society than before. Now look, please, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say that life in the year 350 was heaven on earth. It certainly wasn't, especially by our modern standards today. But I'm here to say this, is that things got considerably worse after the fall of Rome. Now, in the midst of that chaos and going backwards that descended upon the Western world, I'm speaking about Europe as a whole, one important place where learning, order, technology, and hope was preserved was within the monasteries of Europe. In many communities, the cloisters of monks and nuns became places where something of the past hope and the present security remained, at least in some measure. This was one of the great goods of monasticism in this Christian Empire period. The monastic order of life provided a place where some semblance of learning and culture could survive in the general breakup of society after the fall of Rome. At their best, monasteries were places like intense discipleship schools, and their graduates were sent out to do ministry all over the world that they knew. Now, many in the early medieval West embraced this combined duty of missionary work and being serious about the monastic life. Instead of closing themselves off from the world, many monks, not all, they carried the gospel to distant lands, and monasteries began to become the chief ways that Europe was Christianized. Let me give you an example. There was a Benedictine monastery. Benedictine describes a monastic order after the rule of Benedict, somebody we're going to talk about shortly. A Benedictine monastery in Canterbury, England, played a very important role in preaching the gospel outside their community and converting and baptizing many. According to the early English historian Bede, they admired the simplicity of their holy lives and the comfort of their heavenly message. Now, eventually, the monastic work and evangelism centered in this monastery in Canterbury, England, brought about the conversion of King Ethelbert of Kent, whose wife, Bertha, was a Christian from France. Now, at that time, England was in many ways still a half-tribal society. And in many tribal societies, the lower social classes tend to follow whatever the king or the chief does. So there in Canterbury, and really this was replicated in many places in Europe, conversion tended to be from the top down. So again, this English historian Bede tells us that Ethelbert let his followers decide for themselves whether or not they would become Christians. You know, he had kind of come to the place where he thought it was better for individuals. But because they understood that the king and the upper classes of the tribe were now becoming Christians, they wanted to become Christians. Once the king was converted, it gave the missionaries the protection and the freedom to preach and to build churches throughout the kingdom of that now Christian king. So the many stories from this period about early Christian monks illustrates the challenges that they would have living in the early Middle Ages. They would have barbarian invasions. They would face war. They would face religious persecution. They would face famine and poverty. When the 6th century came around, they'd had even further disasters. There was a great outbreak of the bubonic plague that swept through the Middle East and much of Europe. In the face of these kind of threats, the monks embraced a radical way of living out the gospel. Instead of viewing the monastery as a place to retreat from the world, many, not all, but many monastic leaders offered spiritual encouragement and intercessory prayer for their neighbors all around them. Now, the monastic ideal, what they were striving for, what they were achieving, was originally based on the ancient idea of the hermit. The hermit lived all alone, usually in a barren wilderness, and the solitary life of the hermit was supposed to give them deeper communion with God. Maybe you've felt that there's been times when it was beneficial for your spiritual life to get away from everybody else and just go seek God all by yourself. Spend some time with the Lord, just you and Him without any other distractions. Well, the hermits were people, the Christian hermits, were people who said, I'm going to do that with all of my life. I'm going to remove myself as much as I practically can from the company of other people and just live my life with God. Now, this kind of seclusion was sometimes just the natural outgrowth of persecution, because when people were being persecuted in cities, they would flee out to the country and often live in very small groups or alone. But later, especially when the empire was largely Christianized, the Christian community generally thought that this was the way that a person could have the closest possible walk with God. So there was the idea of isolation, but another foundation of the monastic life was asceticism. The idea that it is good and noble to deny yourself certain things. At least in the modern Western world, We live in a very self-indulgent age. There isn't much that we deny to ourselves. But in the early church and beyond, it was part of standard Christian teaching and practice to deliberately deny yourself some things. Now, Christians, often young people, would seek out these Christian ascetics under whom they might learn the way of self-denial. In Alexandria, the theologian Origen, we've spoken about him in previous lectures, he lived in the early 3rd century, and he taught new converts about Christianity, and he amazed them with the way that he denied himself, with the things that he renounced. For example, Origen would sleep on the floor. He would go barefoot for long periods. He would practice extreme fasting, and he would abstain completely from wine or any kind of alcoholic drink. There were many men such as Origen. In the 4th century, again in Egypt, Egypt was a center for a lot of this. One man named Hieracas, he formed an ascetic association. These were individuals who came together for study and worship. Now, these Christians would reject traditional marriage, and instead they sort of promoted what they called an ascetic companionship. The partners in these companionships would renounce any kind of sexual activity, but they would live together, a man and a woman, but they would renounce all sexual activity. Christian leaders such as Athanasius thought this was crazy. You're needlessly tempting yourself. It's fine if Christians want to renounce marriage and live as celibate, renouncing all sexual relationships. But to live together with another man or another woman and say, well, we'll just stay pure, this is a foolish invitation to temptation. Another man that we'll talk about more later, Jerome, he was the spiritual director for a group of wealthy women in Rome who wanted to learn these ways of self-denial and asceticism. Jerome felt the heat of social disapproval because his disciples would do things that were unusual for women. They would study the Old Testament in Hebrew. They would give themselves to sort of radical, extreme ascetic practices. And when one of the young widows under his supervision died from excessive fasting, at least seemingly so, he was forced to flee. So he settled in Bethlehem. Jerome and his colleague Paula, she was the mother of that widow who died, they established a monastic foundation for men and women. These communities of ascetics became very popular and common. But men like Anthony of Egypt, he gave the example of the solitary monk alone in the desert and the wilderness. Now, we've spoken previously a lot about Anthony when we talked about Egyptian and Ethiopian Christianity. So I'm not going to speak too much about Anthony right now, just to remind you that he lived in the deserts of Egypt and he was deeply impressed by the story of the rich young ruler from Mark chapter 10. He applied the words of Jesus to the rich young ruler to his own life. And so he sold everything and gave the money to the poor. He said goodbye to everyone, and then he lived alone. First, he lived alone near his house, under the discipleship of another man who lived an ascetic life. Then he lived in a tomb. And finally, he lived far away in an abandoned fortress. Twice a year, friends would bring him food and he would drink nothing but water. He decided that he would never comb or cut his hair except at Easter. And as was typical for many hermits, Anthony described seeing very strange visitations of demons and having many intense temptations in the wilderness. All of that was intended to distract him from his relationship with God. Again, that's all we're going to speak about Anthony at the present moment, but he was an extremely influential hermit or ascetic, really inspiring a lot of people to the monastic lifestyle. Another notable group of hermits were the Stylites. Sometimes people call them the Pillar Saints. They took their name from a certain Simon, or Simeon, I should say, who died in the year 459. Simeon imagined that by living at the top of a pillar, his soul would be closer to God. So he started with a pillar that was 6 feet, that's 2 meters high, and then he gradually increased the height until he lived for 30 years on top of a pillar that was 20 meters high. That's 60 feet tall. He had many visitors, and he preached to them from on top of the pillar. His followers became known as Stylites. These were a group who followed in his footsteps. Stylos is the Greek word for pillar, and so these were just like people who lived on pillars. So these isolated desert monks, this is what they found. They found that their temptations came to follow them out in the wilderness. If they had left the city to avoid the many temptations that they could find there, they found that in isolation, that environment often encountered intense spiritual warfare with the demonic. Or if they left the company of other people, they thought that they might not be so sexually tempted, but they found that sexual desires and thoughts often carried on in their mind, even when they were out of the community. Most of them believed that a very carefully controlled diet helped. So the monastic diets would vary, but bread, lentils, and vegetables were among the staples. Ideally, the Bible was the ultimate guidebook for these men and women. They read it very carefully, and they memorized as much as they could. Though he could not read, Anthony paid such close attention when he heard the scriptures read that his memory served him in place of being able to read books. Other monks memorized large portions of scripture, especially the Psalms, and they meditated upon those Psalms. There's an ancient rock-cut tomb, I believe it's in Egypt, used by a monk as a living place. And the monk who lived in that tomb, he painted the first line of each psalm on the wall of the tomb where he lived that would aid him when he wanted to repeat what he had memorized of the psalms. He would know how it began. You could see how the scriptures were important to them even in their isolation. Now, over time, there developed many different monastic orders. And they were usually distinguished by the way that they dressed and by their particular rules. Often, these monastic orders were named after their founder. The Benedictine order was founded by Benedict. The Franciscan order was founded by Francis, and so on. Benedict's order and the rule of Benedict were very influential. Benedict was a nobleman who became a hermit in the Italian countryside in the 6th century, just say around 500. He was said to be a healer and a holy man, and people were drawn to him. Before long, he was asked by a group of local monks to lead their monastery, and he agreed. But when he laid down his rules, they soon thought that he was too strict, and they rebelled against him. Twice, his own monks in those early days tried to murder him by poisoning. So he left that monastery, I think that was a good idea, and he organized 12 other monasteries, and he established his famous Rule of Benedict. Let's take a few moments to talk about some of what's in Benedict's rule. It was written around the year 529. One writer, Hugh Feiss, he writes this. Monastic rules were more than lists of do's and don'ts. They were blueprints for an ordered and celibate form of Christian life that had been growing in the Christian church for 200 years before Benedict. Again, continuing to read from Hugh Feiss, he says this. He based his own rule on an earlier one, such as the anonymous Rule of the Master. But it was Benedict's little rule for beginners that became the gold standard for Western monasticism. In short space, in about 50 pages in modern editions, Benedict wrote a rule noteworthy for its wise moderation, biblical grounding, flexibility, and an interweaving of spiritual teaching with practical directives. So let me read you a few selections from Benedict's rule. Here's one part. In every aspect, all shall follow the rule as their guide, and let no one depart from it without good reason. Let no one in the monastery follow his own inclinations or brazenly argue with his abbot. The abbot, for his part, should do everything in the fear of the Lord and in obedience to the rule, knowing that he will have to account to God for all his decisions. So again, just sort of that very basic idea. Look, we're going to come together and agree to keep the rules. Well, what if somebody didn't keep the rules? Okay, Benedict's going to go on. Again, this is from Benedict's rule. If a brother is insubordinate or disobedient, proud or a grumbler, or in any way acting contrary to the holy rule and despising the orders of his seniors, let him, according to the Lord's commandment, be privately warned twice by his seniors. If he does not improve, let him be publicly rebuked before them all. But if even then he does not correct himself, he should be excommunicated, if he understands how severe this penalty is. However, if he is beyond conviction, he should be physically punished. Well, Benedict's rule could get pretty tough. If a guy won't listen to the encouragements, to the rules, then, well, he should be beaten. Let's continue on. I find this interesting. I hope you do too. From Benedict's rule, he writes this. The brothers shall take turns to wait on each other so that no one is excused from kitchen work unless prevented by a sickness or taken up with some vital business. An hour before each meal, the week's servers are to receive a cup of drink and a piece of bread over and above their ration so that they can wait on their brothers without grumbling or undue fatigue. At the brothers' mealtimes, there should always be a reading. There shall be complete silence at table, and no whispering or any voice except the readers should be heard. The brethren should pass to each other in turn whatever food is needed, so that no one needs to ask for anything. If anything should be wanted, ask for it by sign language rather than by speech. So much of the monastic life in the rule of Benedict was about being quiet. They would come together with meals and not speak a word except for the reading that was given for the reader for the whole group. And so this idealization of silence, this idea of the contemplative life, very strong in the Benedictine tradition. Let's keep reading here from Benedict's rule. Idleness is the enemy of the soul. Therefore, at fixed times, the brothers should be busy with manual work, and at other times in holy reading. A mattress, woolen blanket, woolen under blanket, and a pillow shall be enough bedding. Beds are to be searched frequently by the abbot for private belongings. And if anyone is found to possess anything he did not receive from the abbot, he shall be severely disciplined. To abolish private property, everything necessary shall be given by the abbot. A hood, tunic, shoes, long socks, belt, knife, pen, needle, handkerchief, tablets, so that they can have no excuses about needing things. I think you can kind of get a feeling for what a highly controlled community this is. There was to be no private property in a strict Benedictine monastery. And the abbot would inspect the rooms of the particular monks. And if they had anything of their own private property, they were to be severely disciplined. Let's do one more reading here from Benedict's rule. He wrote this. We intend to found a school to train men in the service of the Lord, but where we shall not make the rules too strict and heavy. If we seem to be severe, do not get frightened and run away. The entrance to the path of salvation must be narrow, but as you progress along the life of the faith, the heart expands and speeds with love's sweetness along the pathway of God's commandments. So again, just from reading those passages from Benedict's Rule, I think you get a feeling that, properly speaking, a monk's life should be pretty strict, pretty severe. They should be very dedicated to what they're doing, live in a common way, much communion with God, but also much common labor together, manual labor together. Now, this was, of course, the monastic ideal. Throughout European history, monks and monasteries developed the reputation for being filled with lazy people who did no work and weren't really serious about their relationship with God. Whether that was an accurate criticism or not, well, I'll leave that for you to decide or other people to figure out, but it was a criticism that was often made against monks and monasteries, that they were just filled with lazy people who did nothing. But as you can see, that was not true of the monastic ideal first laid down in Benedict's Rule and other monastic orders that followed similar sort of patterns and rule books. Matter of fact, let's take a look at this. If we're talking about laziness, let's take a look at a typical schedule for a Benedictine monk. What would they do? Well, first of all, starting their day at 2:30 in the morning, they would rise for communal prayer called the Divine Office, or in Latin, the Vigils. Then from 3:45 to 5 in the morning, private reading and prayer, learning psalms and other texts for the Divine Office. Then at 5 o'clock to 5:45, communal prayer at dawn. That was called the Lauds, again in the Latin. At 6 o'clock, they would have communal prayer at sunrise. Then at 6:45 to 8:30, work, housekeeping, crafts, gardening, and field work if necessary. Back at 8:30 for communal prayer. From 8:45 to 1 o'clock, private reading. Then 1 o'clock, communal prayer again in the middle of the day. At 1:15, they would have a meal together in the dining room in silence with a public reading. 1:45 to 2:30, you could take a nap or read again. At 2:30, communal prayer again. 2:45 to 6 in the afternoon, you would work. 6 to 6:45, communal prayer again. These were the different prayer services through the day. 7 o'clock, there would be a meal together in the dining room, again in silence with a public reading. 8 o'clock, the last communal prayer of the day. And then finally, at 8:30 in the evening, you would retire to your dormitory, to your sleeping room. Now, let me just say, if you followed that kind of schedule, you would want to go to bed at 8:30 in the evening as well. Properly done, the monastic life was hardworking, dedicated, industrious. But just like with everything, it often did not live up to the ideal. Well, at its best, the monasteries and the monks were real places where wisdom and godliness and learning was preserved. So let's just take a look at a few sayings of some monks, kind of more from the Eastern tradition, these particular sayings. We'll take a look at some of these sayings of the monks so that we can get a feel just for how they thought and their wisdom. So here's some wisdom from the monks. Here's something from a monk called John the Short on fasting. This is what he said. If a king wants to take a city whose citizens are hostile, he first captures the food and water of the inhabitants of the city, and when they are starving, subdues them. So it is with gluttony. If a man is earnest in fasting and hunger, the enemies which trouble his soul will grow weak. Again, this sort of explains some of the mentality behind the monastic life. The idea is, hey, I can be stronger against temptation. I can be stronger in godliness if I will afflict my flesh and learn how to deal with those things through the practice of fasting. Here's something from a monk named Poemen. Poemen said this: teach your heart to keep what your tongue teaches others. Well, That's pretty simple and pretty straightforward, isn't it? If you're going to teach others to do a particular thing, you should live that way to do. You should keep it in your heart as you teach it to other people. Here's a monk named Agatho speaking about anger. He says, if an angry man raises the dead, God is still displeased with his anger. You know, I like that. I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. Our personal sins are not excused by the way that God may use us. I thought that was a very wise thing from that monk named Agatho. Let me give you one more from a woman, nun, of course, named Matrona. She says this, many people living secluded lives on the mountain have perished by living like people in the world. It's better to live in a crowd and want to live a solitary life than to live a solitary life while all the time belonging for company. Again, I think there's a lot of wisdom in what that nun named Matrona said. It's not just where you live, it's the interior life as well. And monasticism at its best helped people to really go deeper with the Lord and in their life. But it didn't always work that way. You could argue whether it was more common or not for it to be of real spiritual benefit to people. Here's another one. I'm not going to put this out on the screen, but there was a monk named Abram who asked Poemen, he asked, why do the demons attack me? So Poemen said to him, do the demons attack you? The demons do not attack us when we follow our self-wills, because then our wills become demons and themselves trouble us to obey them. If you want to know the kind of people with whom the demons fight, it is Moses and men like him. So again, that monk's encouragement was simply to say, if you're being attacked by Satan and his agents, the demons, that shows that you're at least going in the right direction. I'll give you one other here little wisdom from the monks on the subject of lust. There was once a disciple of a great old man, and he was tempted by lust. The younger man was. When the old man saw the younger man struggling, he said, do you want me to ask God to release you from the trouble that you have with lust? And this is what the younger man said. He said, Father, I see that even though it is a painful struggle, I am profiting from having to carry the burden. But please ask God in your prayers that he will give me the long suffering to enable me to endure. So the father said back to him, now I know that you are far advanced, my son, and beyond me. So again, just this simple idea, just wisdom from the monks that we shouldn't seek to be released from all of our burdens and even our spiritual burdens, but we should ask God for the strength to be able to bear them. Now, there was a lot good and wise and helpful, and I would even say necessary for the continuance of Western civilization within the monastic movement and within the monasteries of Europe. And in the East as well, because in some ways the monastic movement began in the East and flourished in the East before it came more westward. A lot good there. But let me add this. The monastic movement was bad in the sense that it cultivated often, not always, of course, but it often cultivated a false idea of spirituality. The idea was that if you were really committed to God, then you would shut yourself off from society and you would just simply live in the monastery or the cloister. This led to what some people considered a two-level system of Christianity, where the real Christians lived as monks, but sort of the low-level Christians lived in the outside world. Yet it was also true that in this period, the church became more and more institutionalized and less of a living and active organism. The church became more like a corporation. The Bible, because of the institutions of learning and literacy were much less than before, the Bible became less available and Christians became far more superstitious. By this time, true, so to speak, true Christianity became more and more defined by the monks and the nuns. Now, it's true that not every monastic order, because there were many, were cloistered. Some orders went out preaching the gospel and meeting the practical needs of people in everyday life. In fact, during this period, as I mentioned before, monks were at the forefront of spreading the gospel to unreached peoples. The gospel continued to spread, especially among the barbarians. The Picts were converted by 400, the Irish by 435, the Franks by 496, the Scots by 563, the Angles and the Saxons by 600, and the Goths by 720. And again, those were very much due to the works of the monasteries and the monks who lived within them. Listen, it was sort of a problem when the monastic orders became the definition of a two-tier Christianity, and you weren't a real Christian unless you were in the monastery, and when the monasteries were too cut off from the outside world. I would say those were the two greatest dangers or problems with monasticism. Not always the case. Some monastic orders, in particular monasteries or abbots or whatever, they were powerful and beautiful, but there were problems associated with it. So I would say that monasticism as a whole was good. Sometimes it was bad, but it was also useful. Let me explain to you what I mean by that. Monasticism was useful because new monastic movements were created to absorb reform movements in the church. When an energetic, popular reformer came along, such as somebody we're going to study later on in our lectures, Francis of Assisi, he would become the head of his own monastic order, and his followers would join the order. This was a way to take reform movements within the Western, that is the Roman Catholic Church, and keep them within the church, but still not let them truly reform the whole church, but yet still have some influence. So if I were to sort of summarize this lecture, I would say it simply on these terms. Monasticism was good in many cases, especially as it kept alive Western civilization and culture and order and literacy and the rest of it. Monasticism was good often. It was sometimes, or maybe even often, bad or became bad, and it was also useful in many ways. So that's our brief survey of monasticism from this early period of the Christian Empire era. Again, we're talking about approximately 312 to 1000. We'll talk more about monasticism later because some of the most important Christian leaders that we're going to speak about, both in the earlier period of the Christian Empire and the later period of the Christian Empire, many of the most important leaders come from the monasteries. And this, of course, was part of the good that at least the monastic movement could do. Hope this lecture is helpful for you. Thanks for joining us. I hope you can join us for future lectures as well.